Made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
You're tuned to AM 580. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Ursula Blomberg was 10 years old when she and her parents fled Eastern Europe to escape the Nazis. The year was 1939. Europe was at the brink of war and the Holocaust. Ursula and her parents boarded a steamship bound for China. All over the world, nations closed their borders to Europe's Jewish refugees. Shanghai took them in. Along with the Blombergs, thousands of Middle European Jews fled to Shanghai. While Shanghai offered shelter, it presented many challenges. Ursula Blomberg Bacon is our guest today. She joins us to talk about what it was like to come of age when the world was at war. She is the author of Shanghai Diary, A Young Girl's Journey from Hitler's Hate to War-Torn China. It tells the story of Ursula and her family from March 1939 when they left Germany through the summer of 1947, when Ursula and her husband, Wolf, left for America, and to 1953, when, along with her parents, the family was sworn in as citizens of the United States. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Ursula Bacon settled in Denver with her husband, where they raised two children. Today, her home is in Portland, Oregon. She lectures and conducts writing and publishing workshops. Her book, Shanghai Diary, A Young Girl's Journey from Hitler's Hate to War-Torn China, is published by M. Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ursula Bacon, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for asking. I'd love to.
My pleasure. My pleasure talking with you. You say in the foreword to Shanghai Diary, you set out here not to write a book, but to tell a story. Why did you decide to tell this story, and why did you wait so long to tell it?
Well, I wanted to tell the story. Finally, it dawned on me that there's only one book, a strong book on the market that discusses the view of these years, these terrible and challenging and often, of course, devastatingly horrible years from a young woman's point of view, which is the Anne Frank Diary.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be, ambitious as it may sound, I wanted it to be a counterpart to that story except with a happy ending. And I wanted people to know, especially in the kind of society we live in today, and the work that I do with children here and all over, is that to spread the message even more and more that hate and prejudice do not work, that we have to respect one another for who we are and go about our own way.
Yeah. At the end,
I just wanted to document it, and I also wanted to honor the people who came into my life and brought their gifts to me and made me grow up differently.
Yeah. While these are years filled with hate, there is so much love in this story.
Well, maybe it was because we really didn't know it and perhaps didn't know how to voice it, but it's the only thing that has worked. And we stayed a very tight little family group with very few friends. We didn't really spread ourselves about very much, and so we kept that love in, under one roof, and it kept us all going. And a father and a mother with an incredible positive attitude. And my father, the very first day in Shanghai, turned to me and said, "Look, child, learn it. Learn the lesson. Learn it now. What you can't change, don't complain." And it was that simple.
Yeah.
And we've learned. It was often said and well learned. If you can't change it, don't complain.
Yeah. And after all those years spent there, from 39 to 1947. When you left in 47, right at the end of the story, you had no hate.
No. No, I didn't like, as I said in the book, I didn't like what has happened to us. I did not like that we had been called subhumans and that we've been robbed of our purpose and to follow our star. But, you know, I've lived so long now, and it's awful to say that because I lie about my age so much, my children are now older than I am. But it really, nothing else works except being kind to one another. And we still have a long way to go before we realize that.
Yeah.
And it worked for us. And, you know, even in Shanghai, in the ghetto, 18,000 to 20,000 refugees living together in the same squalor, and some of them had a little more than others, but basically the circumstances were difficult. Still, the Viennese people really didn't like the Berliners, and the Berliners didn't like the one from Prague, and the Prague didn't like the Polish people, and the Polish people didn't like anybody. And this has to stop.
Mm.
It has to stop, and that's perhaps I'm so adamant about writing this book to show it hasn't worked. Nothing has been achieved except heartache.
Yeah. I had no idea prior to reading this book that Shanghai became home to Jewish refugees during the war. And 18,000 to 20,000, that's a significant number.
It is, but I think the lack of publicity about this situation was that it wasn't a death camp, it wasn't a concentration camp, there were no gas chambers, and it just sort of went by the wayside. There are quite a few other titles out on that subject, written by refugees who lived through it, but they're quite differently done. They're done without the, as I said, without the passion of growing up and the marvelous thing that happened to me. People say today often, sometimes when I speak, oh, we are so sorry that you had to go through this. Well, I never have looked at it that way.
Mm.
I was a curious child. It was fascinating to be in China. Just think. Marco Polo was there before me. Of course, he came back too.
Well, tell us how, as a little girl on the steamship, you imagined China and what it was like when you set foot, when you stepped off the plank.
That's true. We had lovely pictures, and I always call it page 99, with these elegant, little, slender little young women in their beautiful silken gowns and their deep slits on the side, big hairdos, carrying little umbrellas, traipsing over little arch bridges and catching their reflection in the little sparkling ponds covered, some of them covered with water lilies and hummingbirds on chrysanthemums. And that's what I thought of China. And, you know, it was the beautiful architecture, the swirled roofs, those house gods squatting at each end of a roof, protecting the house from evil spirits, and the pagodas, the gardens. And when I arrived in Shanghai, Shanghai 1939 was still colonial. Part of the city had been leased by the English people. A sign on the waterfront read, Chinese and dogs not allowed at this park. The Chinese were sort of guests in their own country. And the colonial attitude was quite overwhelming, and the Chinese, of course, looked at all foreigners with jaundiced eye, to say the least, because they were certainly not friends.
Mm.
And then we arrived in downtown Shanghai. That's where the ship docked, and all of a sudden there were thousands of people trying to cross the street, of feces and urine running wild, of children and playing in it, of beggars hovering in doorways and on street corners with their horrible diseased limbs exposed, the smell of human excrement all over, the strange cooking smells mingle in with it. I know, I've always said this, my mother clutched a white linen handkerchief to her nose and kept it there for 8 years. But it was quite a shock. You know, today people go to, I always say this jokingly and honoring their trip, but people go to the Orient, to perhaps Hong Kong, to buy Christmas presents. They stay at the Hilton, and they come home and want to convince me they experience culture shock.
Hmm.
And there's, of course, nothing like it. So much has changed in China. It is Shanghai no longer is that armpit of the world, as they used to call it, and the pimple on the fanny of China.
Yeah.
It's an exciting city. It really was exciting in many ways, especially as a child. I was raised so old, I spoke German, French, and English when I came to China. I was home-raised with governesses, and all of a sudden I had freedom, and I was in charge of my parents. They didn't speak English. So So I had a very, I thought I had a very exciting time.
Yeah.
Later on, of course, it became very, there were very many desperate hours, but still.
Well, tell us a little bit about what your life was like prior to 1939.
Well, prior to that, my father, well, it's sort of a fun story because we, my father's father, my grandfather, had seven children, none of whom had any children, so I was the only grandchild and niece in a rather large family of very well-to-do people, and everyone lived on funny little old country estates and had a very charmed life. And my mother came from very modest circumstances. They came from the province of Upper Silesia, where her father was had a little tavern, and my father was stationed there during World War One and met her and fell in love with her the first time he saw her. So she brought the balance into, she was not impressed with wealth, or with, she just was a very practical lady who also had a good philosophy. When she told me once, when I cried a lot when I, in the first, at night when I thought everyone was asleep, and I went back to my childhood days where things were safe and clean and smelled good. And one day she said, you know, don't look back. You get a stiff mind and a stiff neck. Mm. So the days we had, they were, became a dream, and we never revisited that dream ever again.
Yeah.
And when I came to America, the dream became, no longer was my old former home, you know, sort of the destination of a dream. I'd come home to America. It was a wonderful homecoming.
Mm. Back to your mom, your mother taking you in hand when you would be so homesick and say, look, memories, they're important. We all have them, but you must be careful with them.
She was very, very, she put it very eloquently, I think. She said, memories are like a picture book. You open the book and you look at the pictures of the past and you recall these, the lovely fragrances of flowers and trees and the smell of baking bread and all the marvelous things that happen. And then when you're through looking, you close the book and the pictures stay inside, because if you live in the past, you cannot treasure the present and you certainly condemn the future.
Hmm.
And we became very much living in the moment. The Jewish religion was part of her life until she became so angry with God that she wouldn't go to temple anymore. And she was an interesting woman.
Hmm.
My father was a marvelous man who absolutely had no... I know people would approach him on the street and people were desperate, they were hungry, we were sick, and said, well, Mr. Blumberg, isn't this terrible? And my father would grin with his big, scrawny face and he'd say, do you have anything better? If you don't, this has got to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that life is about people. It's really not about events. The people who come into your life and help you grow and change and look at things differently. And of course, once we landed in the ghetto, first event, we moved out of this poor part of Shanghai when we had a few $100 came to us from some friends in America. And we moved into the French Concession, which is a lovely little suburban area. And we, modest quarters, again, just one room, but it did have a bathroom and a tiny kitchen. And I went to the school with the Catholic nuns. They took in 15 children each year with free tuition and even free uniforms and rosaries. And so I went to school there, and my mother became sort of upset one day, and she said, you know, I'm a Jew. Your father became a Jew. You cross yourself at the dinner table. And my father said, so? She's breaking out with a rash? Only one destination and many roads.
Yeah. And your father also said, you know, it couldn't hurt to cover God's major bases.
That's right. He did say that. And my mother then said, well, finally said, well, one of these days she's going to bring in a Buddhist. And when I did bring in my Buddhist monk, she crossed herself.
Yeah.
But I learned. There was so much to learn. And I really feel we have so many opportunities to make the best. And I'm not Pollyanna, believe me. I was hungry and I was unhappy. I was a growing girl. When we were later on, the Japanese put us in that ghetto, and, you know, my shoes, I was growing. I was 5'8". And I looked at my shoes, and I said, Mommy, my feet hurt. My toes went out. She said, good, get the scissors. So she cut the top off my shoes, and she said, good for you. You now got sandals.
Mm.
And two, for some reason, she snuck, I think one or two, I'm not sure if it was two, but I know it was one huge chiffon ball gown into that suitcase because there was a lot of fabric that wrapped up very small. And I'll tell you, my poor father, I bet he was the only man in town with a pair of undershorts, three layers pink chiffon. And he was dreaming of boxer shorts at Hanes, I'm sure, by the time he lived through that.
Yeah.
And I was a growing girl, and, you know, a bra made out of three layers of chiffon isn't much of anything.
No, yeah.
But we made do. We kept our spirits up, and it was not always easy. I heard my mother cry at night. I saw my father stare into the air with no destination.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, 18,000 people in the same boat. Some of them committed suicide. Some of them became beggars. And some of them just made it by sheer will.
Yeah. How many would you say made it by sheer will?
I've always heard 18,000. I've always also been contradicted with 20,000. I don't believe that the accounting was that accurate. But it was between 18 and 20,000 Middle European Jews from Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia, or even as far as away as the West Coast, as Holland and Belgium.
Yeah.
It was the port of last resort. It was an open port, no landing money, no visa necessary.
Yeah. After the war ended, you were still there in Shanghai for some time.
Yes.
What was that like? What was all that waiting like?
Well, we knew it would be a long wait because so many people. At that time, America was still operating under the quota system. I don't really know that much of how it is today. I always know that a lot of foreigners come in large numbers. And I don't think we have that quota system as much anymore. Well, we were very lucky. The American army came in about a week after the war was over. The first ship arrived, you know. Those little sailors swaggered onto Shanghai's city streets. It was a marvelous sight. And, you know, at that time, the United States wanted to protect China from becoming communism. So the army moved in along with other, diplomatic corps, of course. And there was thousands of Americans were there. So they all settled into offices, and we had a repatriation center where people were sent back to. Soldiers came in from China, Burma, India, from the whole war theater of war to be processed in Shanghai to either re-enlist or return home or stay on duty. So the jobs came open, and I took a job. I was hired I was 15 years old, lied about my age, and got a job in the dispensary, keeping records of arriving and departing soldiers and the health records. And it was wonderful. I learned all about America. I lived with them, literally. Mm. They were so kind. They brought us vitamins. I weighed 89 pounds when the war was over, and I was 5'8". My mother was quite ill, and the first package of sulfur tablets that arrived cured her. And we received combat rations, for food. It was a wonderful time, and we just admired America. My father, as you read the book, never knew for one moment doubted that America was not going to win the war, and this was going to be an end, and he was going to become an American, which, of course, he did eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting time for me to get to know America.
Yeah.
I knew what two bits were. I knew what a dime and a nickel was. I knew all about hamburgers, Coca-Cola, and popcorn. And I learned from the young soldiers. They pulled out their wallets with the pictures of their families, their uncles or aunts, their sweethearts, their children. And I saw all sorts of wonderful sights, backyards with picnic tables. Oh, I came home to America. I really did.
Mm.
Except I spoke quite very much like a limey then, like an English person, which I tried to change. I never was too successful at that.
Mm. Well, what did applying for entry to the United States involve in those days?
Involved the same thing it did before. We had to have a sponsorship. We had to have a document from someone in America guarantee us the first 5 years of our lives in America before we became citizens. We had to have an affidavit that we would not become, that this person was responsible for our financial situation. We were not able to get welfare or anything like that. We had to be on our own. And then we had to wait then we waited for the American consulate to open again, and we stood in line probably for 4 or 5 weeks every day. We had sort of took numbers that we had the same place every day to register again to come to the United States. And the German quota was had become quite large then because 5 years of war, there was no immigration. But it still took 2 years before we received our quota to come to America.
Hmm. What an amazing place Shanghai must have been. Not only were there Jews from Eastern Europe, there were Russians who had been living there for some time.
Yes, they came from 1919 at the revolution. We call them White Russians.
Yeah. There were Japanese.
Yes. Every language, I believe, that God has ever created on this planet was spoken, and you could hear it almost every day on the street.
Yeah.
It was an interesting. It was a place also where, of course, a great deal of trade happened, especially from England at the early days. And the black sheep of the family was always sent to the Shanghai branch. And my father started this painting business, as I mentioned in the book, and it was hysterical that we painted opium dens and decorated houses of flowers, as we called it, gently. And I grew up with all that, and it was just exciting, I thought.
Hmm. Well, tell us about your father. Let's go back and talk about your father. It seemed that for any person that he ran across who was a decent person, it was like he knew them forever.
Oh, he did.
No strangers there for
well,
your dad.
You know, he said that the world is full of wonderful people and I know them all. Later on, he added a little word, said, and the others don't count. But he made friends. He spoke pidgin English. He never learned to speak decent English. He was hysterical. He sounded just like any Chinese on the street. You know, me no want you, you no got you, we no go, yes we go. No come, no go, no have, no get.
Well,
he made himself understood because he always smiled and he always had a bunch of little children following him. He loved to two-step down the street and do a little dance and make up a Chinese sing-song song.
Yeah. And he had a Chinese business partner in the China Art Painting and Decorating Company.
Yes, he did.
And you also were an important part of the business.
Well, very often I had to go and interpret Mr. Mm-hmm. Yang, our Chinese partner, or comprador, as we call them, also at other businesses. So very often father needed somebody to translate Chinese. So after school, I would rush to wherever he was in a rickshaw. And, well, it's hysterical, but, you know, we painted houses of ill repute.
Right.
And that's where I met these darling little girls, too. They were so elegant. They taught me how to eat slippery noodles and slimy mushrooms with chopsticks. It taught me all about the quality of jade. And they talked a great deal about their business. So I learned a lot there.
And how good are you
and
at
I tell you, when I came back to school the next morning and I saw Mother Superior, I was never afraid that God would find out what I did in the afternoons.
Mm.
Where I was, but I was scared that Mother Superior would find out and I would be kicked out of school and sent to hell.
And your mother, how did she think about the opium dens and the sing-song houses that...
Well, she was quite embarrassed, especially the houses of ill repute. You know, we were still... But it was such a different culture. None of these places had the kind of odorous, you know, view that we have in America today. It was all sort of, quote, fun. Opium dens were not fun because it was truly the decay of the Chinese people in so many ways. It was an awful sight, and Mr. Yang only let me see it twice, and he said he'll never go back there again, which was fine with me. It was an awful sight.
Mm.
But the gambling houses were fun. People were screaming and yelling, and money passed and crossed tables was quicker than the tick of a clock, as I said. And then I took a job teaching English to three young women who lived in a magnificent villa with General Yi. We never were quite sure who he was and what his position was. You know, I knew he was very wealthy, and he had this darling, call them his three sisters. And I wondered, well, how can they be three sisters? They all come from different provinces, and they're all 18 years old, and they're not triplets.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally discovered they were very honorable concubines. And I taught them English, and we had a fun time. We were, you know, we had nothing in common except the time we spent together, little refugee girl with a big nose, and they did call me Da Pizza for big nose, and three little girls who lived to be puffed and powdered and pretty, and enjoyed playing jokes on each other. and on everyone else. Just children, playful children.
Mm-hmm.
Who just, as I said, they spend the general's money with great glee for American cosmetics and French perfume.
Do you
and
think
I became part of that world. I saw them every afternoon, five times a week. We had 4 hours of English lessons.
Mm.
And we learned to play together and became very fond of each other.
Yeah. Do you think it was easier for the children of refugees to adjust to life in Shanghai than it was for their parents?
Well, I think it's easier for children, but I also believe very much it is the parents who set the tone. The complainers and the whiners, and there were people who came to America afterwards. I met them from Shanghai, who expected great things from America. They expected to be rewarded for what they had been through. And I always found that quite almost obscene, because we all paid a price, and we came to America, and we were given the opportunity to be ourselves with freedom and choices. And I thought that was a grand gift, a country that took us in so lovingly.
Mm. Ursula Bacon is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Shanghai Diary, A Young Girl's Journey from Hitler's Hate to War-Torn China. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area and it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Ursula Bacon, when she was 10 years old, she and her parents fled Eastern Europe to escape the Nazis. Shanghai took them in when the rest of the world's countries, the nations of the world, would not take them in. And along with Ursula Blomberg and her parents, thousands of Middle European Jews fled to Shanghai. The Blombergs were in Shanghai until 1947, when the family left for America in 1953. She and her parents and her husband were sworn in as citizens of the United States. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Your memories of these years seem so vivid. Why do you think you've been able to recall so many of the details of these years you spent in China?
Well, Celeste, I think, first of all, when you have no distraction from your days, you don't have a movie to go to, you don't have any swimming holes or tennis courts or picnics or anything, and your daily life becomes so ingrained in you that you simply can't, this is all you remember. And then when my children were born, from very young age, I would tell stories at the dinner table. Pretty soon they brought their friends in and said, Mother, would you tell them how you lived? I went to the schools early on to talk about it. Friends, we made new friends who were curious about our life. So I just kept it alive.
Yeah,
and the people, the few people who I mentioned in the book all lived in Denver. And we often got together and we talked about Shanghai. They were really years that formed and shaped us and made us so grateful. And also, you know, you live in Denver, Colorado, all of a sudden you're sort of interesting because you lived in China. Very few people, even as a child, I remember that my parents had some friends who had traveled as far as India. But in 1939, Shanghai or Hong Kong were not a destination for vacations. There were only 7 or 8 ships, both freighters, a few more freighters, I guess, but only 6 or 7 ships that even passenger ships that traveled that route from Southampton all the way to China, because it was truly not a destination vacation. So that when Shanghai finally became aware that Shanghai was a place we could go to, then all of a sudden there was no transportation to it. The tickets were bought up and snapped up within seconds, literally.
Mm-hmm.
3 ships from Genoa and 3 from Germany traveled that route. And the rest were steamers and clippers and merchant ships, who don't take many passengers, as you know, 5 or 10 perhaps at the most. They were not equipped for that. So it became premium to go to Shanghai was all of a sudden, all over Germany, people were looking for passage.
Yeah.
And we were just terribly lucky to have managed to get the passage. The day we managed to get the tickets, as my uncle did, the ship was already sailing from Hamburg that night. So we had 7 days to catch it and make it to Genoa 7 days later.
Yeah. This involves the beginning of the story. At the outset of the story, your father has been arrested and your uncle, Eric, arranges for his release and your passage to Shanghai. And these tickets are, you know, so...
Yes.
They are, you know, they are so precious. And you are the one, a 10-year-old girl, who has to go and get your father.
Well, that's true. I was almost 11, though. There's a little misunderstanding about my age for some reason.
Well, in the book it says 10, and on the jacket it says 11.
Yes. I don't know how you know how typos happen. And I always joke that I was born in 1900 in typographical error. And it certainly came true now. Well, I was almost 11. I would have been 11 that. This was March, and I was 11 in October. But there was a great fear of being associated with helping a Jew, both from Jewish people, excuse me, and from non-Jews. So my uncle just took one look at me. I'm 5'3". I'm very big for my age. I was an old child to begin with. You know, some of us are so old when we're born.
Mm.
And he said, she can do that. They'll leave her alone. And they did. They did. But I also believe that my uncle paid enormous amounts of bribery money to make this transaction fairly smooth, even though my father had been hurt and beaten badly when they handed him to me in a burlap bag.
Yeah.
But he was all right. He never spoke about what happened to him. It must have been, I suppose, not. It wasn't the pain, perhaps, but they were so ugly, and they created and developed so many ugly, brutal, demeaning ways to kill these people or harm them, that people just wouldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Just like this friend of ours, you may remember, Mr. Max, who became such an influence in our life, they were lined up against the building with pitchforks and pushed from the upper floor. Jews were pitched out the window to land on those forks. Those memories people just didn't want to have.
The family that remained in Europe.
We never heard from them again.
Yeah.
I think they were all Auschwitz. They were all. And even my father's youngest, or rather his older sister and this one brother, were very active in helping Jewish people escape. My aunt she purchased a little truck. I don't know what kind of a truck, but it had a truck bed like a farmer's truck. And a chauffeur taught her how to drive it, and she would buy vegetables from the farmers and layer them on the truck bed, and she would train about 6 to 7 little children. She would take them in the house, Jewish children, and teach them how to be quiet and how to breathe through a little tube. And then she would lay them flat on the carrots and cover them with hay and drive them across the border into Switzerland and deposit them at the doorstep in the middle of the night at some, you know, a religious house, a church or a nunnery or a cloister. And that's how she brought more than 200-300 children out of the country. Finally, she was picked up and was sent to the Warsaw Ghetto. And then her brother, who did the same thing only differently, also was caught, and they met in the Warsaw Ghetto and died in that ghetto at the uprising. So Hitler was really quite serious about following his plan to, you know, the word genocide, we didn't know it then, at least we didn't call it that. Ethnic cleansing, that's what it was all about then.
Mm.
The last century created quite a few words that men could be ashamed of. But as my mother said, when the war was over, you know, you sort of get a guilt complex and say, why me? What is there about me that made me not share that fate of a gas chamber? And then Mother said, you know, we have to live where all of those died, and we have to make our lives count. And perhaps she's still with me because as I mentioned to you earlier, I go into the prisons and try to teach women how to run their lives a little better, how to document their lives with journaling. I speak to an average of 1,000 or more school children every year. when we talk about hate and prejudice, when we talk about love and gratitude are the only thing that really work. So that's where I spend my life, and I really have a grand time.
Back to Shanghai in the years between 1939 and 1942, difficult, very difficult, but relative peace and stability. Then 1942, Pearl Harbor, still things are fairly quiet, but the following year, 1943, you have to move back to Hongkou.
The axis was formed between Italy, Germany, and Japan. And Japan, apparently, they did. The Nazis were very quite well represented in Shanghai. You barely could walk the street without seeing a Nazi uniform. It was Hitler's fifth column, as we called it, as it was called, perhaps correctly so. And then Japan finally had to give in, and the Nazis, as far as we know, wanted them to create a camp for us, an actual camp, like a prison camp, or 20,000 to feed 18 to 20,000 people, even the worst slop in the world, was going to be costly. Time would have been wasted in building barracks, and it just wasn't possible. So they decided to take an area that was already inhabited by, I would say, some people say 50,000, some people say 75,000 Chinese, and approximately 10 blocks either way, 10 square blocks, and they threw barbed wire around it and gave us 6 weeks to find quarters in there. So we had to find a room to live. And we finally found a room that we would share with another couple with a very thin plywood wall between us that didn't reach the ceiling. Our room was about, I think, 11 by 12 that I lived with mother and father for 3 years. And you really have to become almost saint-like to not look at each other's flaws and not get annoyed with idiosyncrasies or characterizations that you don't like. Somebody snores at night. You just have to become totally... My mother called it, we are opting for sainthood living together in these tight quarters. And not quarrel, still like each other, respect one another. She was a marvelous teacher. Mm. She held together the threadbare hearts of ours with incredible courage, and I call it Jewish resignation. A white tablecloth was on that tiny table with four linen napkins, a little vase with three roses, silk roses from a ball gown. Dinner conversation during the camp time, or ghetto time as it was called. Dinner time consisted towards the end of the war of 5 pounds of potatoes every day. Or dish of rice, excuse me, or glass noodles or whatever. But mother cooked them so differently, I always say jokingly, Martha Stewart, eat your heart out. She'll never figure out how to cook potatoes 700 in different ways. And the conversation had to be about arts, literature, or music. It could not, we were not allowed to discuss the Cohens next door and their bad habits or the conditions on the street or the killing of a Jew or the suicide or the hunger or the despair. It was about literature. It was about music. Because Mother said these beautiful things were created to keep us above the line of despair. I was so lucky with the people in my life.
Yeah.
And then came my lovely monk, who was a Eurasian. He had an English mother and a Chinese father, who was on his hunger march of all things during that time. And he added his wisdom of his Eastern teachings to my searching little mind. And I learned from him to say, I'm not the victim of my circumstances. I'm the beneficiary of my choices. I can't blame the world for who I am. I'm my own work. When I mourned the death of a friend, he would say, listen, we didn't come here to stay. We came here to go. And on came the lessons every day, and I mean that. And that's how we learn. We would go to each other's tiny little rooms. The rumor would go around. The Cohens in lane number 2, between 3 and 5, they're going to talk about Tchaikovsky, but they'll have room for 2. So that's how we learn. The adults took over. The ghetto mind of the Jew took over and educated its children. We had an education beyond description when we came to America. When I watched my children going through school, and when my son finally was the first one to graduate from high school and went to college, to him, for me watching him graduate with what he knew in 12th grade compared to second grade for us in China. We had teachers who were surgeons and engineers and bridge builders, composer, conductors, scientists, researchers, people who worked with Einstein. We had an incredible education.
How did you cope with the news, though, that was coming from Europe in those years?
Well, they were hard. At first, they became very, very few. I mean, far and few between. But we knew that Jews were constantly being picked up, loaded into trucks, and, quote, shipped east, end quote. That's all we knew. And my father kept saying, if this is bad, then Europe has to be a nightmare. It has to be the pure, pure hell, and these people are not going to live. Mm. And he knew that. And that's why the gratitude each day, he would say, Shanghai, as I ended my book, Qian Qian, thank you very much. Mm. We were left alone in a misery, yes, but we didn't have the daily fear of being arrested or taken away or killed, mm. even though they threatened. But we never really took that seriously in China.
While you were in China, you met Wolf?
Yes, I met that marvelous family, and I think I was 12 when I met them, and he was maybe 19. And I took one look at that fun young man. I knew I was going to marry him. It took him 4 years to catch on. Boys can be so slow. Finally, I said, I'm going to America and a married lady, and you're going to marry me. He said, oh, okay. And, you know, we had no normal childhood or upbringing or experience of teenagers. We had no place to go. We had no place to play. We were always among adults. We always had chaperones because we all lived in one room. And as I said to me, the word privacy to me as a young child always meant closing the bathroom door. But I learned very quickly that privacy is a wonderful gift of being alone, being by yourself, discover yourself. But living with mother and father in one room, it would be, take that off, that doesn't look good. It's too long, it's too short. What are you writing, dear? Let me see when you're finished. Mm-hmm. Don't sing that tune, you're off key. So this threesome had become a onesome. Not out of curiosity or being nosy, it simply we became a unit. And each other's feelings and emotions rubbed off on the other, and we were responsible for each other. It's a very strange life.
Yeah.
Today, I love walking through my house in the middle of the night, even when the children were small. Everyone was asleep, and I had extra rooms to walk into where I was alone. It's a wonderful feeling. Mm. So one becomes grateful for so many things that obviously most people take for granted. Even my children take everything for granted today, I think. Mm.
I understand you're at work on another book.
It's the prequel. It starts with my mother meeting my father and then takes us out of... And it goes into this... It will have some other facts involved in it. It's all based on truth, but not necessarily... It all not happened just to our family, but I wanted to make it a richer experience. You know, for instance, the conflict between a Jewish, non-Jewish marriage. All of a sudden, my father was offered the possibility of remaining who he was and just divorce his wife and get rid of her and the Jew child. But he wouldn't do it.
Mm.
So that's why the incarceration for that time he was picked up. So that's what it's about. And a fabulous grandfather, who I always jokingly say, or rather repeating what my mother taught me that he was, the original con in Europe. The Robin Hood, who robbed from the rich and gave it all back to the world. Interesting man, fun man. So that's what the book is about. And then finally, the deceit and the treachery that we went through from at the hands of other people who would turn people in just to become important mm-hmm. in the party.
Yeah.
So I hope it's going to be as rich as I've been told this book is.
Well, I look forward to it. And maybe we'll
be out next year, and of course, the Shanghai Diary will be a motion picture.
Terrific.
Nancy Siegel, who wrote this screenplay for Frida is doing this screenplay. So I'm very excited about that. You know, you don't have as much say as you wish, but they stay very true to the story. It's rather fascinating watching it come to life.
Yeah, well, I would imagine it will make a wonderful film.
There was a movie years ago, perhaps you might remember it, called The Inn of the Sixth Happiness with Ingrid Bergman and Kurt Jurgens. If you haven't seen it, do pick it up sometime. It will give you a view a little bit of the interior of China at the time that I arrived there. And it's a wonderful movie. But it was a China that no longer exists.
Mm.
So that's why I always say get our storytellers going, because we're not going to be here forever.
Mm. Well, I look forward to reading your prequel, and maybe we'll talk again.
I would love that, Celeste. I really thank you so much. You're lovely for you to have me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Take care. Happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving, and please stay in touch.
Will do.
Thank you.
Ursula Bacon has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you're interested in this story, pick up Shanghai Diary, A Young Girl's Journey from Hitler's Hate to War-Torn China. The book is published by M Press. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the bean pit finished the day higher. The wheat was lower, as was the corn. We'll start in the wheat pit this afternoon. December contract at 313.5 on the high, the low at 301. Settlement price there, 302. They were off 7.75 cents today. The March contract in the wheat, 323.5, the high, the low at 311. Settled $3.12 a bushel, down 7.75 cents. And the May contract at 330 high, low at 317.5, settled at 318 in the May, down 8.5 cents. July futures, 336.5 high, low at 327, settlement price at 327.5, down 5.75. And the September wheat, 341.5 the high, the low at 334.5, settled on that low, 334.5 the settlement price for next year's September wheat, down 5.5 cents at the Board of Trade. From the corn pit at this hour, $2.25 was the high in the nearby December contract, the low at 197.25, settlement price at 197.5, and they were off a penny and 3/4 today. The March futures, 210.75 high, low at 208, settlement price at 208.25, off 2 cents. And the May contract in the corn pit, 218 the high, the low at 215.25, settlement price at 215.5, down a penny and a half. July futures, 225.75 the high, the low at 223, settled 223.25, down 2 cents. And September corn, 232.5 the high, the low at 230.25. September for next year, settled 230.75 a bushel, down a penny and a half. December contract for next year now, 241 the high, the low at 239.5, settled 240. They were off 0.25 cents for the day. December oats at this hour, 150.75 the high, the low at 147. Their settlement price at 150.25, they were off 3.5 cents for the day. And the nearby March contract at 154.75 high, low at 151, settled 151.25 in the oat pit, down 0.75 cents. January soybeans, 557 the high, the low at 547.5, settlement price at 554.5. They were up 4 cents. The March contract up 4.5, a 560.5 high, low at 551.5, and a settlement price at 558.5. Once again, that March contract in the bean pit up 4.5 cents a bushel. May futures, 565.5 the high, the low at 558. Settlement price at 564.25. They were up 3.75. In July, soybeans, 572 the high, the low at 564. Settlement price at 571.25, down, or rather up 4.5 cents for the day. Here in the August soybeans, 574 the high, the low at 569, settled at 574, they were up 4 cents. September futures, 575.5 the high, low at 572, settled 575, up 3 cents for the day. And next year's November contract from the bean pit, a 585.5 high, low at $5.78 a bushel, settlement price at 584.75 in the Nov for next year, and they were up 3.5 cents today. December bean meal, 159.50 the high, the low at 157.70, settlement price at 159.30, up 110. And the January bean meal, 161.70 the high, the low at 159.40, settled $160.60, and they were up 40 cents. December bean oil at 21.80 high, the low at $21.33, settled 21.71, up 22 cents. And the January oil, 21.95 the high, The low at 21.46 settled 21.85, and they were up 18 cents for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Looks like a mostly lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange for livestock prices. January feeder cattle, $100.90 the high, $99.40 the low, finishing at $99.52.5, that down 110. March, $96.30 the high, $95 even the low, $95.50 the settlement, that down 62.5. April, $95.30 the high, $94.30 the low, $94.30 the settlement, that down 62.5. December live cattle, $85.20 the high, $84.35 the low, $84.65 the settlement, that down 15. February, $86.35 the high, the low, $85.55 the settlement, $85.95 that down 12.5. December lean hog, $74.90 the high, $74.27.5 the low, the settlement, $74.80 that down 2.5. February, $74.07.5 the high, $73.30 the low, $74.02.5 the settlement, that up 62.5. April, $71.40 the high, $70.85 the low, the settlement, $71.32.5 that up 15. And May lean hog, $70.80 the high, $70.40 the low, finishing at $70.65 that unchanged. February bellies, $99.85 the high, $98.80 the low, $99.20 the settlement, that up 20. The Dow is up 36 points at 10,493. The NASDAQ is up 10 at 2,080. And the S&P 500 up 6 points at 1,176.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, featuring Dia de los Muertos, a celebration of art, music, words, and dance. Starts October 25th and runs through December 4th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Brian Price from Ames, Iowa writes, "Dear Dr. Science, when I was a child, I used to believe in fairies. I believe that fairies brought autumn gold to leaves, that they brought frost to the window panes. I even believed in the tooth fairy until I was in high school. Now I don't believe in anything, even science. Can you help me in my crisis of faith?"
Have you considered Rush Limbaugh? Yeah, nowadays many people put their faith in Rush. I used to believe in Gore Vidal, but now I find myself believing more in Joe Bob Briggs or Tom Tomorrow. Of course, any expert's only as good as his data. And anyone with a modem can cruise the internet, accumulating megabytes of useless data. Pictures of Cindy Crawford, shareware that's not worth the trouble to learn how to use. Now, if you're going to believe in anyone, believe in yourself. Now, come to think of it, you'd be better off believing in me.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science...